Welcome to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, the show where timeless wisdom meets modern research and where we explore the ideas, innovations, and human stories shaping the future of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michelle Hammond, and today's conversation is one that feels both timely and deeply important. My guest is Rob Verkerk, sustainability scientist, executive and scientific director of the Alliance for Natural Health, and one of the leading voices challenging how we think about human health, food systems, environmental exposure, and disease prevention. For decades, Rob has explored the interconnected relationship between people, planet, and health, questioning whether modern living has moved us further away from the very conditions humans need to truly thrive. In this episode, we explore the growing burden of chronic disease, nutrient depletion, environmental stresses, resilience, prevention, and why the future of healthcare may depend less on fighting disease and more on understanding what creates health in the first place. This is a conversation about connection, critical thinking, personal responsibility and possibility, and one I think will leave you reflecting long after the episode ends. So settle in and let's begin. Rob, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with me here on UK Health Radio for Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science. Thank you so much for joining.
It's an absolute pleasure being with you, Michelle.
And so, Rob, you have an incredible backstory and 40 years committed to integrative health and well-being. So before we get started, tell us about your background. Tell us about what led you to where you are and what you're doing now.
Well, I should say it's 40 years dealing with all aspects of human interaction with the environment. And I have spent roughly half of that dealing with environmental and agricultural issues, and the other half with health issues. So the bottom line is food is the most intimate way that we experience the external environment. And we have, my interest as a scientist at Imperial College was how can we develop agricultural systems that work with nature rather than against it? So we would use rainforests and coral reefs as systems that we needed to understand in depth. And in order to have a system that was then less dependent on external inputs, fertilizers, pesticides, you need to find a way in which that matrix of life can be stable. And one of the, you know, profound conclusions that we drew over many years is that you need complexity to have stability. So, for example, if you have a monocrop of wheat, as not so far from you as East Anglia, and there's a lot of arable farming there, you'll see that when a fungus or an insect comes into that environment, they have a very large food source available to them. It's very difficult to have a complex of what we call natural enemies that can actually manage that system. And increasingly, as I was doing the work and understanding that the role of phytochemicals, these plant secondary metabolites, were critical to managing the system and synchronizing these very complex 4, 5, 6 trophic levels, all these different organisms feeding on each other to be able to create complexity in the food web, but also stability in the system. So when you look at a rainforest, for example, you'll see that very rarely do you see complete defoliation in the way that you might see it when, you know, you see an arable crop or a vegetable crop being ravaged by a particular pest. But if you go into it, you will find all these different elements represented, all in small numbers, all managing each other. So I've always been interested in the health side personally because I'm chemically hypersensitive. So I've generally leaned towards an organic, natural diet from my early 20s when I realized I needed to stay away from chemicals because they'd make me very sick. But there was a time at Imperial College because we would get together as ecologists and agricultural scientists with medics in South Kensington. And I was talking to a leading oncologist, cancer professor, and I said, you know, we're finding these really interesting secondary plant metabolites in cruciferous vegetables, the cabbage, broccoli, large-scale family. And what we've found is that where we have sufficient amounts of them, which we don't seem to see so much in modern-day cultivars of these vegetables, we find them in the heirloom, the old varieties that our grandparents used to consume. We find that the whole trophic, multitrophic system basically becomes synchronized. If you put a lot of water and a lot of sugars and you take out these secondary metabolites, if aphids or caterpillars come into that system, they generate so fast, they become essentially like human beings who consume high carbohydrate diets in the Western world. And then the other trophic levels cannot be synchronized to that. The whole system goes out of balance and bingo, it's deemed that pesticides are the only solution. But I said, we've researched these compounds. We can see that there's a big data set showing that they have cancer protective properties. Are you looking at this? Just the reaction. The reaction changed the course of my life because the reaction was, are you crazy? You know, he literally looked at me as if I had two heads and said, we use chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation. That's what we do. It works very, very well. And that was the end of it. And, you know, it just caused me to really think carefully. Shortly after that, I was offered permanent tenure at Imperial College. And then I had to think, is this really what I want to do? And in fact, I accepted twice and turned it down three times. One of the most difficult decisions of my life. And it was actually when a very senior member of staff said to me, Rob, having full tenure at Imperial College, we don't know of anyone who's ever turned it down. And then he said, it's all about kudos. And I said, thank you, I've made my decision. And I left and I established the nonprofit Alliance for Natural Health in response to that as a vehicle for essentially my life's work. And that vehicle was about how do we create health systems that work with nature, much in the same way that I'd been looking at how we, from an academic perspective, also I was very involved in projects in Eastern and Southern Africa and Central Asia and Southeast Asia to implement that kind of way forward. And it was really quite transformational. So I guess over the last 25 years, we've been working with principles, but also understanding that it goes so far beyond the science. You have political, regulatory, economic, all sorts of forces that get in the way of creating a system that would be of ultimate benefit to human beings. Very often what we see is a system that benefits certain corporate interests, certain political interests, and is less beneficial for human beings. So that's why we work politically. It's why we essentially also use the totality of available evidence, because when you're a researcher at a university, the goal is to keep doing new research. And I was astounded by how much really good research is just left on shelves, so to speak, and isn't used. And that means science as such is failing. And of course, the scientific method, as far as I'm concerned, is being completely and utterly destroyed. It's a system that's been around for thousands of years, and it's not being used properly because of the way in which it's being manipulated and twisted by corporate and political interests.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it, that there's so much research out there, and yet for some reason it doesn't seem to sort of push forward. And as you say, there's lots of rationales and reasons behind that. And I know one of your core messages in the Alliance for Natural Health has been around how we make modern healthcare pivoted and focused on creating health and preventative disease rather than the current system, which seems to be about managing the disease. So in your experience now, how do we do that? How do we move forward and get to a point where we're using that evidence, using that research and changing the way that the current system is set up?
The current system is really locked into a paradigm that no longer makes sense. And it is born out of a sort of Pasteurian idea. Pasteur, you know, developed the germ theory, this idea that there was infectious disease that needed to be nailed by some kind of external input. We still basically have a system that focuses on disease. In my view, if there is a coin that has on one side disease and the other side health, we essentially conflate health with disease all the time. And that is at the root of the problem because we're focusing on the wrong side of the coin. So we have a situation now where chronic diseases and degenerative diseases, both of which even the World Health Organization will tell you are predominantly preventable, happen to the majority of people, particularly in the industrialized world, but increasingly in less industrialized nations as well. And essentially, if we use the analogy of a motor car, it's like we decide to not service our car on an annual basis. It's as if we just run our cars until they break down, and then we go and ring up the garage and say, hey, can you help me? Now, we all know with a motor car that does not work. And yet, we use that very system in healthcare. Even if you use the motor car analogy, look at the way insurance works. Insurance basically incentivizes you not crashing into other people or destroying your car, and you get this thing called a no-claims bonus. In healthcare, in the UK, obviously, we see a prime example with a system that is free at the point of use. Of course, the taxpayer makes a substantial contribution to it, but there is absolutely no incentive to maintain a healthy body in the way that there is an incentive to maintain, you know, a healthy motor vehicle. So, you know, the system then breaks down, and we have essentially what I would term a reactive healthcare system. We know a lot about these pathologies that dominate cancer, heart disease, obesity, type 2 diabetes, osteoarthritis, neurodegenerative conditions. These are the conditions that are now threatening to actually collapse the healthcare system as we know it. And while we see in his previous job, Wes Streeting, trying to do his best to try and reduce waiting times, there is still politically not the desire to try and establish a system that really creates health rather than manages or treats disease. Tony Blair basically commissioned Derek Wanless, the previous head of NatWest, to commission reports back in 2002 and 2004. To look at why the National Health Service was failing. I was actually invited into one of those Chatham House rule meetings to take in information on what is going on in the system. And of course, he famously said, look, the problem is the National Health Service is not a healthcare service. It's a disease management system. So, you know, 24, 5 years on, we have a system that has not fundamentally changed. Yes, there's a 10-year plan, but essentially the system is not very different from any other system. And we've been evaluating regulatory systems in 18 different jurisdictions around the world, focusing particularly on the United States and European national systems, as well as the European Union systems, but also looking at other countries from Russia to India to South Africa, Australasia. And they all have the same footprint. Essentially, they create a regulatory system built around drugs and foods. Drugs are the exclusive category that can be used therapeutically, legally. So if you are a medic, if you're a healthcare professional, be it a conventional physician or any other kind of health practitioner, you're treading on really dangerous ground if you say, do you know what? Stop using those drugs. Because there's a whole bunch of science out here that says that if you eat in this way and you move in this way and you think in this way, you react to the world around you in this way, we can prevent disease. Not only that, if you have specific kinds of disease, we can reverse them. So there are massive risks. And at ANH, we've spent years defending both conventional doctors who moved into the integrative medicine space, as well as other non-medical healthcare practitioners, when they get jumped on by regulatory agencies. So the entire regulatory framework is established to maintain monopolies in which big pharma and big food essentially control those monopolies. And it's a tough ask. And you know, this is why COVID has acted as a very interesting juncture for people to rethink. Is this a system in which we can really rely on our so-called democratic governments to resolve, or should we just do it ourselves? And there is a really inspiring grassroots movement that's developing around the world that we are very much part of that is saying, do you know what? We're pretty much giving up on the idea of a top-down solution. The real solutions are going to be bottom-up, and we're just going to rebuild communities. We're going to rebuild systems that make sense to us, and we're going to try and live outside the system because it's broken, it's damaged, It's failing. Look at the deficit, the financial deficit that all major countries are in at the moment. The system is broken, and we may be reaching the end of a cycle in which there is a recognition that this system is no longer fit for purpose. And that's why it is a natural response that we look to nature. We're in from nature, we're of nature. When we align with nature, things tend to go quite well. And so that grassroots movement, I believe, is a natural response to technological monopolistic system. We can refer to it potentially as a corporatocracy that does not work for the people.
I couldn't agree more. It's so frustrating, isn't it, in so many ways. Have you seen from evaluating the countries that you've looked at, and obviously COVID having impacted everywhere, that escalation and that grassroots movement as a direct result of COVID and people having to look for themselves and question the science and question actually the evidence out there?
I think Yeah, totally. I think experience was a big part of it. I think the other part of it was this breakdown in trust, both in governments and in this thing that became termed the science.
Yes.
You know, the science was a manipulation of science. And I think it is directly linked to people's experiences, because people rapidly realized that the science that they were being told, the narrative, was not neither scientific, and very often it was shown subsequently to be incorrect. It was, again, benefiting the companies and the governments that were essentially delivering those messages. So once that trust breaks down, and you can look at pretty much any index of democracy, the Economist's index, democracy index, is well known. And what we're seeing is, even since the beginning of COVID, where I think the number of people globally who were living under what the Economist rates as full democracies has dropped from a tiny 8% to an even tinier 6.4%. So we definitely have a situation in which authoritarian creep is at work. And if the people no longer trust that system, that authoritarian system, you have not only the situation which social conflict will develop, political conflict will develop, you also have people who are not inspired to start, you know, attacking their governments, just going off and doing their own thing. For me, that is the inspiring part. That's the most inspiring part of all of this. And of course, coming back to nature, what we also see in nature, that there's a fantastic Canadian ecologist by the name of C.S. Holling, who's now passed on. He developed this concept of the adaptive cycle. His life's work was essentially showing that all natural systems go through four basic phases. And those phases are initially a growth phase, and you can liken it to the seasons, because seasons go through a temporal adaptive cycle as well. So that's the spring, in which you see rapid growth of the system. And when you see that growth has to, it can't continue forever. It's essentially what is one of the reasons we have in economics, typical boom and bust. You cannot have indefinite growth of an economic system. You cannot have indefinite growth of a population. So essentially that growth then becomes conserved. That is the second phase of conservation that then drops into release. And that is the letting go. It is the harvest. It is the autumn in which the leaves are lost. And then the fourth cycle, before you go back into growth again, is this reorganization cycle. And that is the winter. And if you look at a landscape, you will see essentially what looks like not a lot going on in the middle of winter. But underneath the soil and within the rhizosphere and within the plants and within the, you know, dormancy or low metabolic activity of all the fauna within that system is an extraordinary amount of reorganization that basically improves the adaptive response to the next cycle. And subsequently, people have taken Holling's adaptive cycle into business environments, that take them into personal relationships. And what we see is that this cycle exists forever. You can even look at human civilization and human evolution have not gone through a staged linear growth process that we're often led to believe when we look at standard models of evolution. And yet the way in which we're taught history does not deal sufficiently with the fact that we have seen extremely advanced civilizations previously. Look at Egyptian civilization, Mayan civilization, as just two examples. And some would say, well, Let's look at Atlantis. Let's look at Lemuria. What about these totally lost civilizations for which there appears some evidence? Let's look at archaeology, or there's some fantastic work going on by Dr. Osmanagic, Emir Osmanagic, who's the founder of the Bosnian pyramids, that again suggests that much of this history is incorrect. And what we have seen is a series of very rapid development of human beings that may have had inputs. The concepts of astrobiology have never been disproven. We are essentially stardust that is then separated from nature and, you know, into this system that we call a living organism that is a combination of cells that create that separation. And then we have this genetic code based on a four-letter alphabet. But that is common across all living organisms that we know about on this planet. But that evolution has not been a linear process. It probably does fit closer to C.S. Holling's model of an adaptive cycle. And some would say the fact that we can see what appears to be a collapse of social systems, that appears to be a sort of lack of fit between the technological systems that human beings have developed, what we might think of as the technosphere, with the emotional and psychological development of human beings. Those two things no longer fit, which is one of the reasons we see this extraordinarily important and, you know, sad, potentially tragic problem that so many young people now feel. And we don't have the tools to be able to deal with the mental health crisis that's occurring amongst young people who somehow seem to have lost an ability to find meaning in their lives because they've been diverted and disconnected from the things that human beings really need to be able to function as whole, high-resonant beings.
Pause that thought. We're just going to take a short commercial break.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, where I'm in conversation with the brilliant Rob Perkirk. Let's dive back in.
And I think that's so true, and it's so evident in my work as a practitioner, and I'm involved in a charity that supports young people. And not only do we see the massive escalation in self-harm and suicidal ideation, but even just general levels of anxiety and, as you say, disconnection. And actually, I think what's even more devastating is that sense of hopelessness, as you said, that lack of purpose and sense of direction. And some of that's fear-based because they're seeing the world erupt and, you know, people fighting and wars breaking out and poverty and deprivation. And then they're also worried about the environment and the kind of global issues that, you know, are impacting their safety and their fundamental sense of security in the land that they live. But also in the advances of tech, of what that means for their future. And as you say, you know, that's advancing at such a pace, but completely polar opposite to where people really need. And COVID escalated and showed us just that sense of sort of simplicity and sort of recalibration to sort of the basics. It's mind-blowing. And actually, it's not just young people, is it? I mean, we're seeing that mental health crisis across all ages. From your perspective, how do we anchor people back to what's important and remind people of how they can take greater autonomy and play a bigger part and role in their own health and well-being.
I think the starting point is to reframe the moral compass. In fact, there is no compass anymore. It is interesting how humans have built systems that are based on a metaphysical or spiritual belief of something that's bigger than themselves. Think of it as God or Allah, that have been sort of dominant systems for a long time, particularly in recent times. But even prior to that, if you look at any of the ancient civilizations, there was always something there because there was a connection with the metaphysical that then gave, if you like, an ethical framework in which it would be fairly clear what the right thing, what right action was all about. I think as we've become increasingly a technologically driven species, we have moved away from any sense that that moral compass is the framework that helps us make decisions day to day. And if we look at the healthcare system, we're building a whole new ethical and bioethical framework for healthcare at the moment. And it is astounding, even if you look at the fundamental four principles of medical ethics that have been accepted by the British Medical Association, the American Medical Association, etc., they are disregarded, you know, almost entirely. The four principles are: one, autonomy. So you always put your patient first. You allow your patient to be the prime decision maker. You work in a sort of joint decision making environment because you have specialisms as a healthcare provider that they don't have, but ultimately they should have autonomy. And built into autonomy is the really crucial concepts like informed consent. COVID was a great example when we saw a complete lack of regard for informed consent. And then even when it was fairly obvious that the COVID vaccines were not going to stop transmission, there was still a very large proportion of people who received experimental mRNA vaccines without any informed consent. Sometimes they were given a piece of paper after the event. But these are really important principles. The second principle is beneficence, to do the maximum good you can for your patient or your client. And the only way that we can do that is to have really deep understanding of all the different aspects that are known about your specific modality, because we know that the human body is a connected system in which the endocrine and immune and neurological system, just to name three, is really one system that has different parts. They are fully integrated, that you would have to exist in a system where you had connection and access to these other specialists in order to be able to do the best for your patient. And that system fails just as much in so-called alternative medicine as it does in conventional medicine. Conventional medicine, you at least see a generalist that then, if they can't deal with the problem, put you onto a specialist. The difficulty is that those specialists are not just specialists, they're hyper-specialists, and they're only given a limited tool set. So the system breaks down because the knowledge base is not sufficiently broad to encompass all the things that might be able to be done to maximize the chances of positive outcomes. And in the alternative side, the difficulty is that the patient has a complaint. It's often still a reactive system. People don't generally see an alternative health practitioner until they have a problem. So it has, you know, an equivalent problem to the conventional system. But then they drop straight into a specialist level. So if they have, say, lower back pain, they might go and see a chiropractor or an osteopath. A friend of mine who was the head of the Organic Consumers Association in the United States, he had exactly that problem. A couple of years ago, I went to see him in Mexico, and he was on crutches. And I said, well, what are you doing about this? What's happened, Ronnie? And he said, well, I'm seeing a chiropractor in San Miguel. And less than 2 months later, he was dead. There was a massive tumor in his spine. So what you think is one kind of complaint, you're not in a position to necessarily be able to diagnose what the underlying problem is. So we have problems in the alternative environment as well. So all of that needs to reframe. The third principle is the one that I think everyone's very familiar with, which is maleficence, which is the basis of the Hippocratic Oath that is no longer required if you join the conventional medical profession. But of course, that says primum non nocere, first do no harm, meaning that you should essentially use interventions, regimens that minimize the potential for harm. And we have a situation in orthodox, so-called conventional medicine, which is really completely unconventional, really, as far as human beings are concerned, in which medications, properly prescribed medications, if you look at the work of Peter Gotcher and others, the co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, who was then kicked out of the Cochrane Collaboration after he revealed problems with the way in which HPV vaccines had been licensed and researched and how that had been communicated to the public and to healthcare professionals. But he argues that the data shows that properly prescribed medicines are the third leading cause of death in Western societies. So, and the fourth area is justice. So is justice being done? And I think then of the increasing number of healthcare practitioners. Even in the United States, it's often regarded as a very liberated, free environment in which the, you know, natural medicine world is allowed to move forward in a less regulated fashion. It is absolutely regulated. And, you know, currently we have at A&H 30 different actions that we're unfolding to try and reframe the regulatory system in the United States. But there are so many integrated physicians, even in the United States, that are being challenged by their medical boards because they're not using a conventional standard of care approach. They're using something different. And of course, we saw that rear its ugly head during COVID with the doctors who were looking at early treatment using a combination of therapies, including ivermectin, colchicine, vitamin D, etc., being jumped on from great heights by their medical boards. So justice does not work either. Now, these are four principles that all the major medical boards are signed up to. Where on earth is that moral compass? And I think that's the starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually when you lay it out like that, you can see why it's unraveled so spectacularly. For people listening, we talk about standard of care a lot, don't we? It doesn't matter whether we're looking at cancer or diabetes or epilepsy, whatever kind of chronic disease we're looking at, there's a standard of care approach in conventional medicine. Who's governing that standard of care? And how does that link to the science and
governed the academic basis. Essentially comes from major universities publishing in major journals and clinical groups that are generally funded by the beneficiary of that research. So when you look at a given condition, yes, there is lip service paid to pharmaceutical interventions. By and large, when the rubber meets the road, standard of care generally uses new-to-nature tools. Tools that are essentially deviations from nature. It used to be that around about 75% of all pharmaceutical drugs had their origin in terms of the molecular structure or some part of the molecular structure that came from nature. Actually, if you look today, it's much, much lower than that. It's probably not much more than 25%. But nevertheless, in that 25%, those molecules are altered in such a way that they have propensity to create some pretty serious adverse events. And you only have to listen to US television commercials or radio commercials to understand the side effects of some of these drugs. Typically, the side effects include death. They include often the very symptoms that are being treated. And I mean, that is this cognitive dissonance problem in which the public have just placed their trust in the people in white coats, even in the knowledge that what they're taking might kill them or deliver even more of the symptoms that they're trying to deal with. But that's because there is not deemed another system. This is the security need that human beings are desperate to find. And, you know, I took a great interest in the way in which behavioral psychology could be used to manipulate whole populations during COVID. And it led me to, I immediately started to think, who has been researching previous historic cases of false ideologies being used to engender genocide? And it turns out that a Hungarian-American scientist, psychologist by the name of Erwin Staub, who himself was rescued by a lady who hid him as a child behind her, as a Jew, when the Nazis came through and were picking up people to dump in concentration camps. And so he spent from that time his entire life looking at what causes people to do horrendous things to other people and deliver a genocidal agenda. And so he was looking at the Holocaust, he was looking at the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, he's looking at the Rwandan devastation. And in essence, people are succumbed to a safety need in which even when they recognize that there is a false ideology that does not make sense to them, they feel safer by staying part of that in-group. And the out-group always becomes the scapegoat, something that you cannot be part of. And that's one of the reasons that choose a name that no one likes to have as a label and give it to them to stop people migrating from the in-group to the out-group. And that's the system that delivers genocide, but it's also the system that maintains the status quo that allows the typical physician to carry on delivering drugs that by and large don't work very well for most conditions, that often yield a series of adverse effects. The integrative personalized medicine show that is organized every summer in London is a great example of the level of interest. In a safer environment, more conventionally trained GPs are going, do you know what? I'm going to attend that conference because I'm going to learn about some things that make me feel better about what I'm doing and may be able to help more patients. And I'm also quite fed up with the fact that there are so many patients there who are asking me questions that I don't know the answer to, and they seem to have a whole lot of knowledge that I don't have, and I want to gain more knowledge. So that also is part of this adaptive cycle of how things start to change from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Stay with us. We're just going to take a short commercial break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, and my guest this episode, the fabulous Rob Verkirk. Let's jump back in to our conversation. I remember it was Robin Daly, the brilliant Robin Daly from Yes to Life, introduced me many years ago to the Good for You, Good for Us, Good for Everybody report that was initiated from sort of government. And it was so wonderful to read because there was this directive from inside the club that was basically going, look, pills and procedures shouldn't be our first line of defence. In and of itself, they have a place, but it shouldn't be our first line of defence. And it was the first time I'd heard something like that. From within the kind of medical system. And it was really inspiring. And then I kind of it sat there and I don't know what's ever been sort of done with it. I mean, even the cancer narrative, if we take that as an example, there's a lot of mainstream medicine will say things like certain cancers can be caused by certain behaviours, whether that's smoking or excess drinking or obesity or whatnot. And there's a general belief that some of those lifestyle choices and activities may contribute to causing cancer. But yet the minute somebody has cancer, everyone's like, no, we'd eat the sugar, do what you like. Hang on, if it mattered to keep us well and prevent it, surely it matters even more if we're unwell.
Cancer patients are a victim of hyper-specialization. The oncologist that is given ultimate control over a patient's destiny is not trained in all of the aspects that are associated with what we know to be carcinogenesis, the process that leads to carcinogenesis, even that very process, there is still a huge amount of science out there that's just being left on the sidelines of conventional medicine that, for example, shows the role of trauma as a trigger, the way in which, you know, someone's emotional health can affect even the pattern of disease. Over the years that I've been involved with Yes to Life as one of their scientific advisors, I've always been stunned when you speak at a conference and then people want to talk to you afterwards. Typically, it'll be a lineup of patients, often with stage four cancer. And these people look like the healthiest people you've ever seen. And they will speak to you in a language that would not typically be found in a conventional oncology department of a hospital, because they'll say, you know, cancer has been my teacher. It has enabled me to understand what was wrong with my life. And now the cancer is in remission and I am learning so much about myself. And I've understood the triggers and the causes, and my life now feels more fulfilled than it has at any other stage. Now, if we were going to approach cancer scientifically, we would have to say, what about these outliers? In every other discipline of science, we look to outliers to understand what works in a system. And yet what the system does is marginalize or ignore those outliers and say, we're not looking at that, you know. So people then are using an integrative approach who will go back to their conventional oncologist, who then runs a series of scans and finds that the cancer is now in remission. I mean, 99% of cases we hear about, an oncologist has no interest in learning what that patient was doing, what the network of other healthcare professionals that help guide them through that process. See, that one of the things we're very strong in ANH is to change the relationship and the hierarchy between a healthcare provider and the patient in order that autonomy can work. And we've got to think about the healthcare provider or health professional as a guide, not a god. We have these series of guides around us. We've been very closely involved with the primary insurer for complementary medicine in the UK, Baylands. And David Baylan will tell you that their research has shown that there are about 6 million consultations with private alternative healthcare providers each week in the United Kingdom. Now, they also know that hardly any of those have any issues in which the patient can come back to the practitioner and sue them or make a claim against them. In other words, the alternative healthcare provision system is very, very safe. It obviously, because of the sheer number of consultations that are going on, is providing a need in the community. But isn't it strange that that need is never recognized, and yet it is being used at a community level all the time? Same thing applies to healthcare stores. Independent healthcare stores should be a hub for this kind of information. Many of them will have healthcare providers, alternative healthcare providers within the health store, providing information to individuals on how they can live healthier lives, what products may help support them. All of that in the overall healthcare equation is ignored. It's marginalized. So we need to readdress that framework of the things that really do work, why they work, understand better the mechanisms in place, and then build from the bottom upwards.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That does create another challenge, doesn't it? There's all this wisdom and information out there, and people are forced then to go and seek it from complementary alternative therapists because, of course, the healthcare provision isn't supporting health. But also that is a minefield as well, isn't it? And we're up against unregulated training and people becoming masters at things in 2 days. And there's understandable question mark on the quality standards and regulations within the complementary therapy, and particularly the alternative sector. And I bang the drum a lot for complementary therapy as an integrative partnership into modern medicine, and using the best of modern medicine, our ability to be able to scan and look and get bloods and analyze what's happening for an individual in this moment. I can't pick up a magazine without somebody recommending the latest supplement or the latest peptide to take. And of course, it isn't a one-glove-fits-all approach under any lens, is it?
Unfortunately, people are still looking for a silver bullet. Whether they're looking at green medicine, blue medicine, red medicine, they're still looking for a magic solution. If you look at the way in which GLP-1, yes, all these people who've battled with a harder way of becoming essentially metabolically flexible. I mean, the solution, the ultimate solution to the obesity problem is redeveloping metabolic flexibility, the ability to be able to use different substrates in different conditions, which is what our bodies, from an evolutionary standpoint, have been trained to do. We're very well adapted to famine, because if we weren't, we would have died. And we do very badly if we feast excessively, and yet we have corner stores and supermarkets around every corner, and we become very readily addicted to things that trigger our reward system and our opioid systems. So we have to learn to become metabolically flexible. But if you look at the language being used by conventional medicine in terms of dealing with the metabolic dysregulation that's going on out there, you will very rarely hear the problem being described as a problem of lack of metabolic flexibility. And yet, if that was to become the focus, and we know scientifically an awful lot about it, you know, how to do it, and yes, intermittent fasting, eating less often, and understanding how we can initiate beta oxidation of fatty acids, and how we can use low levels of ketones to run ourselves when we are carbohydrate deprived, which is what we have been adapted to do, so we can trip our nutrient sensing systems, AMPK and mTOR, for example, that are these incredibly important systems that regulate our whole hormones around satiation and hunger. We can learn to recognize that feeling hungry is actually a good thing, and you don't need to immediately respond by putting in a, you know, a Mars bar or a sugary bar or whatever. Actually, if you hold on to that hunger and work with it, you will need to go through that process before your body then learns, do you know what? Underneath my skin is my long-range fuel tank, that is my adipose tissue that I'm meant to burn, that keeps me going. And if you don't learn to burn that, you just build up more and more adipose, more and more visceral fat, and we have an obesity crisis. So yeah, we often do not look sufficiently upstream at what the real underlying causes of these different pathologies are, and then we fail to look at the things that a human really needs to become adaptive, resilient. You know, resilience is probably the best single term of what we should shoot for, because what it means is that we have an ability to respond positively to stress. And what we need to be able to do is to increase our adaptive capacity, so we're not always running up at the edge of our capacity. This is, so the slightest stressor, whether it's the wrong food or it's an emotional trigger, or it's too much exercise, pushes us over the limit. And so many people in our society are running at the edge of their adaptive capacity, and they have nowhere to go. So, and some of that is caused by the fact that we spend too much of our time in too much physical comfort. So our bodies work well with small amounts of adaptive stress. That's why cold therapy, heat therapy, even the consumption of secondary metabolites in plants, curcumin, resveratrol, their mechanisms, they are toxic to the body, and their mechanisms are built around actually creating an adaptive stress response in the body that then triggers our immune systems to become more resilient in the face of other challenges.
And I think that education piece is massive, isn't it? When people understand what the body needs.
The rite of passage, I have six kids, and what I've done with them all is to give them some kind of rite of passage that pushes them through some major physical challenges. So my youngest two, now 19 and 21, when they were about 16 and 18, I said, look, why don't we do some 1970s backpacking through the Peloponnese Mountains of Greece, and we'll carry everything that we need on our backs, camping essentially, and trekking. And we did it through a heat wave. Temperatures were 3-4 degrees. There were forest fires around. But the kids will say that that's the best holiday they ever had. You see, if you live in a mollycoddled environment, a hermetically sealed environment, living on carpets and in cotton wool, you do not get the kind of stresses that you need to truly become more resilient. So even in the 20th century, playing sport outdoors, regardless of the weather, I mean, think of how few kids do that now and put themselves through that kind of stress. kids used to play outdoors all the time. Now they tend to be sitting in front of a digital device, working their thumbs, but not their bodies so much. So, yeah, time for a big rethink.
Hold that thought. We have a time cut off here on UK Health Radio, and Rob and I exceeded it for this episode, which means to listen to the rest of this episode or to listen to the show in full, you'll need to jump on over to the Teapot Education channel on YouTube. Teapot being spelled T-P-O-T as an acronym for the power of touch. And if you want to jump into learning more about Rob's incredible life's work and that of the Alliance for Natural Health, you can do so by visiting anhinternational.org.